File 43.
We were relieved in the beginning of August. The regiment had dwindled down to a few companies who staggered back, mud-crusted, more like phantoms than human beings. Besides a few hundred yards of shell holes, death was the only reward which the English gained. Now, in the autumn of 1918, we stood for the third time on the ground we had stormed in 1914. The village of Comines, which formerly had served us as a base, was now within the fighting zone. Although little had changed in the surrounding district itself, yet the men had become different somehow or other. They now talked politics. Like everywhere else, the poison from home was having its effect here also. The young drafts succumbed to it completely. They had come directly from home. During the night of October the 13th and 14th, the British opened an attack with gas on the front south of Ypres. They used the yellow gas, whose effect was unknown to us, at least from personal experience. I was destined to experience it that very night. On a hill south of Vervique, in the evening of October the 13th, we were subjected for several hours to a heavy bombardment with gas bombs, which continued throughout the night with more or less intensity. About midnight, a number of us were put out of action, some for ever. Towards morning, I also began to feel pain. It increased with every quarter of an hour, and about 7 o'clock, my eyes were scorching as I staggered back and delivered the last dispatch I was destined to carry in this war. A few hours later, my eyes were like glowing coals, and all was darkness around me. I was sent into hospital at Pasewalk in Pomerania, and there it was that I had to hear of the revolution. For a long time there had been something in the air which was indefinable and repulsive. People were saying that something was bound to happen within the next few weeks, although I could not imagine what this meant. In the first instance, I thought of a strike similar to the one which had taken place in spring. Unfavourable rumours were constantly coming from the navy, which was said to be in a state of ferment. But this seemed to be a fanciful creation of a few isolated young people. It is true that at the hospital they were all talking about the end of the war, and hoping that this was not far off. But nobody thought that the decision would come immediately. I was not able to read the newspapers. In November, the general tension increased. Then one day, disaster broke in upon us suddenly and without warning. Sailors came in motor lorries and called on us to rise in revolt. A few Jew boys were the leaders in that combat for the liberty, beauty, and dignity of our national being. Not one of them had seen active service at the front. Through the medium of a hospital for venereal diseases, these three Orientals had been sent back home. Now their red rags were being hoisted here. During the last few days, I had begun to feel somewhat better. The burning pain in the eye sockets had become less severe. Gradually, I was able to distinguish the general outlines of my immediate surroundings. And it was permissible to hope that at least I would recover my sight sufficiently to be able to take up some profession later on. That I would ever be able to draw or design once again was naturally out of the question. Thus, I was on the way to recovery when the frightful hour came. My first thought was that this outbreak of high treason was only a local affair. I tried to enforce this belief among my comrades. My Bavarian hospital mates, in particular, were readily responsive. Their inclinations were anything but revolutionary. I could not imagine this madness breaking out in Munich, for it seemed to me that loyalty to the House of Wittelsbach was, after all, stronger than the will of a few Jews. And so I could not help believing that this was merely a revolt in the navy, and that it would be suppressed within the next few days. With the next few days came the most astounding information of my life. The rumours grew more and more persistent. I was told that what I had considered to be a local affair was, in reality, a general revolution. In addition to this, from the front came the shameful news that they wished to capitulate. What? Was such a thing possible? On November the 10th, the local pastor visited the hospital for the purpose of delivering a short address. And that was how we came to know the whole story. I was in a fever of excitement as I listened to the address. The reverend old gentleman seemed to be trembling when he informed us that the House of Hohenzollern should no longer wear the imperial crown, that the fatherland had become a republic, that we should pray to the Almighty not to withhold his blessing from the new order of things, and not to abandon our people in the days to come. In delivering this message, he could not do more than briefly express appreciation of the royal house, its services to Pomerania, to Prussia, indeed to the whole of the German fatherland. And here he began to weep. A feeling of profound dismay fell on the people in that assembly, and I do not think there was a single eye that withheld its tears. As for myself, I broke down completely when the old gentleman tried to resume his story by informing us that we must now end this long war. Because the war was lost, he said, and we were at the mercy of the victor. The fatherland would have to bear heavy burdens in the future. We were to accept the terms of the armistice and trust to the magnanimity of our former enemies. It was impossible for me to stay and listen any longer. Darkness surrounded me as I staggered and stumbled back to my ward and buried my aching head between the blankets and pillow. I had not cried since the day that I stood beside my mother's grave. Whenever fate dealt cruelly with me in my young days, the spirit of determination within me grew stronger and stronger. During all those long years of war, when death claimed many a true friend and comrade from our ranks, to me it would have appeared sinful to have uttered a word of complaint. Did they not die for Germany? And finally, almost in the last few days of that titanic struggle, when the waves of poison gas enveloped me and began to penetrate my eyes, the thought of becoming permanently blind unnerved me. But the voice of conscience cried out immediately, "Poor miserable fellow, will you start howling when there are thousands of others whose lot is 100 times worse than yours?" And so I accepted my misfortune in silence, realizing that this was the only thing to be done, and that personal suffering was nothing when compared with the misfortune of one's country. So all had been in vain. In vain all the sacrifices and privations In vain the hunger and thirst for endless months. In vain those hours that we stuck to our posts, though the fear of death gripped our souls. And in vain the deaths of 2 millions who fell in discharging this duty. Think of those hundreds of thousands who set out with hearts full of faith in their fatherland and never returned. Ought not their graves to open so that the spirits of those heroes, bespattered with mud and blood, should come home and take vengeance on those who had so despicably betrayed the greatest sacrifice which a human being can make for his country? Was it for this that the soldiers died in August and September 1914? For this that the volunteer regiments followed the old comrades in the autumn of the same year? Was it for this that those boys of 17 years of age were mingled with the earth of Flanders? Was this meant to be the fruits of the sacrifice which German mothers made for their fatherland, when, with heavy hearts, they said good-bye to their sons who never returned? Has all this been done in order to enable a gang of despicable criminals to lay their hands on the fatherland? Was this, then, what the German soldier struggled for, through sweltering heat and blinding snowstorm, enduring hunger and thirst and cold, fatigued from sleepless nights and endless marches? Was it for this that he lived through an inferno of artillery bombardments, lay gasping and choking during gas attacks, neither flinching nor faltering, but remaining staunch to the thought of defending the fatherland against the enemy? Certainly these heroes also deserved the epitaph. Traveller, when you come to Germany, tell the homeland that we lie here, true to the fatherland and faithful to our duty. And at home? But was this the only sacrifice that we had to consider? Was the Germany of the past a country of little worth? Did she not owe a certain duty to her own history? Were we still worthy to partake in the glory of the past? How could we justify this act to future generations? What a gang of despicable and depraved criminals! The more I tried then to glean some definite information of the terrible events that had happened, the more my head became afire with rage and shame. What was all the pain I suffered in my eyes compared with this tragedy? The following days were terrible to bear, and the nights still worse. To depend on the mercy of the enemy was a precept which only fools or criminal liars could recommend. During those nights my hatred increased, hatred for the originators of this dastardly crime. During the following days my own fate became clear to me. I was forced now to scoff at the thought of my personal future, which hitherto had been the cause of so much worry to me. Was it not ludicrous to think of building up anything on such a foundation? Finally, it also became clear to me that it was the inevitable that had happened, something which I had feared for a long time, though I really did not have the heart to believe it. Emperor William II was the first German emperor to offer the hand of friendship to the Marxist leaders, not suspecting that they were scoundrels without any sense of honour. While they held the imperial hand in theirs, the other hand was already feeling for the dagger. There is no such thing as coming to an understanding with the Jews. It must be the hard and fast, either or. For my part, I then decided that I would take up political work.